I thought I was untouchable. A self-made millionaire, keynote speaker, strategist to the elite. I built my empire on influence. But I lost myself to a girl with a smile sharper than any knife. Her name was Amanda, 25, gorgeous, charismatic. I thought I was mentoring her. I didn't realize I was just her next mark. Trips, sex, and power games. She played the perfect lover, but she had a boyfriend the whole time. And I was just the bridge between her ambitions and their scams. This isn't a story about money. It's about mind manipulation, about the psychology of seduction, and how even the strongest men fall when love is weaponized. My name is Michael Knight, and this is how I got played. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. I've closed billion-dollar deals across four continents. I've shaken hands with kings and sharks alike. I've built empires from the ground up, negotiated in server rooms and boardrooms, stood behind podiums with lights in my face and the weight of market dynamics in my chest. But nothing, prepared me for Amanda Stewart. I met her at a business networking gala in Midtown. I was the keynote speaker that night, a talk on mastering leadership in an age of ethical collapse. Society manipulation, financial disillusionment, market psychology, all of it. I was sharp, polished, wearing a $9,000 Tom Ford suit and speaking in bulletproof metaphors. I thought I was the predator. Turns out, I was already prey. She entered late, like she wanted to be noticed. Red dress, lush curls, the kind of body that makes rational men lose influence over their own decisions. But it wasn't the look that got me. It was the stillness. She didn't fidget like the interns, didn't gawk like the gold diggers. She stood near the back wall, arms crossed, eyes scanning the room like it was a chessboard, like she already knew who was going to fall in love with her, like she'd already chosen me. After the applause died down and people started approaching for photos, handshakes, curated congratulations, I saw her heading toward the bar. Alone, cool, measured, something in me cracked open. Not lust, curiosity. I cut through the crowd and stepped beside her. She looked over slowly and gave me this smirk like a celestial insight had just passed between us. She didn't say hi. She said, "You speak like someone who's used to people listening." That hit me harder than the applause. "And you stand like someone who's used to being watched," I replied. We talked for 20 minutes. About psychology tips, emotional clarity, market ethics, PS1 games, social engineering, and why true leadership is dying because we confuse power with influence. She was sharp, maybe sharper than me. She asked questions that made my mind race. And when I looked in her eyes, it felt like she was studying me, not flirting. Before I left, I reached into my jacket pocket and slid her my card. "Michael Knight, call me. I want to take you to lunch." She tucked it into her purse like she already knew she would. And just like that, she became the most thrilling narrative of my life. The next morning, she texted me. Just three words. "Lunch sounds fun. That simple. That dangerous." We met at the Gramercy Club. I had my driver wait outside. She walked in wearing a black silk blouse and minimal makeup. Still stunning. Still dangerous. But what shook me most was how quickly she adapted to the menu, the atmosphere, the pace of the room. As if she had true body intelligence and social dynamics hardwired into her skin. She didn't talk like a girl fresh out of college. She talked like a woman who had been in rooms men like me pay to enter. "So what exactly do you want from me, Mr. Knight?" she asked, over grilled salmon and champagne. I almost choked on my fork. "Lunch," I said. "Today. And tomorrow? Let's find out." She laughed, but her eyes never left mine. She was already playing. I just hadn't realized the game yet. By the third date, we were fucking. There's no polite way to say that. We were loud. Unapologetic. Raw. Hotel suites. My Manhattan condo. In my goddamn office on the 47th floor, with my assistant outside pretending she didn't hear the moans echo through reinforced glass. Amanda didn't just give herself. She took me, and everything I thought made me the one in control. I thought I was mentoring her. I thought I was grooming her for greatness. But the truth, the dark psychology behind it, is that Amanda already had everything she needed. All she wanted was access. And I was the door. Looking back, There were signs. The way she scanned rooms before smiling. The way she asked for little things. A new phone case, a watch, a ride to a networking event she randomly found. She didn't chase gifts, she chased positioning. She understood social manipulation better than most CEOs. But I didn't see it, because I wanted her to be real. And when a man like me wants something that badly, he'll bury shadowed truths just to keep the fantasy alive. You ever meet someone who makes you forget you've been alive for decades? That was Amanda. She didn't just walk into my life, she reprogrammed it. And I welcomed it like a man starving for intimacy, but too proud to admit it. She didn't talk like a follower. She spoke like someone who'd been watching people like me her whole life, learning how we moved, how we flexed power, how we wanted to be seen. And then she gave it to me. The illusion of understanding. The thrill of the unknown. The positive influence I never knew I craved. By week two, I was adjusting my calendar to fit hers. By week three, she had a spare key to my condo. And by week four, I had introduced her, subtly, to names that don't get printed in magazines. VC partners. Political handlers. A man with three passports and a private server room in Prague. She didn't flinch. She fit in. "You should wear navy at the summit," she'd whisper. "Skip that donor dinner. Let's take a night flight to St. Lucia." It started with style advice. Then my schedule. Then the way I spoke to people. Then how I phrased my captions. At first, I chalked it up to intimacy. She was learning me, contributing, fine-tuning. But what she was really doing was tightening the leash. One whisper at a time. The sex was still nuclear. Hotel balconies. Poolside sunrises. A ski resort in Banff where we barely left the chalet. It wasn't just passion, it was strategy. A masterclass in dark psychology, body intelligence, and power and control wrapped in moans and skin and sweat. And I wanted more. Because for the first time in years, I felt seen. Not just respected, but desired. As a man. As a mind. As a body. I told myself she was different. That she wasn't like the others. "You don't treat me like a sugar baby," she whispered once, tangled in sheets in the Cayman Islands. "You treat me like I matter." It hit me harder than the orgasm. Because it's what I wanted to believe. But it wasn't a compliment. It was a test. Behind the scenes, I began making small moves on her behalf. Introducing her to museum boards. Getting her an invite to a curated art exploration salon. Whispering her name to a billionaire friend who ran a foundation for modern artists. She lit up in public like she belonged. But behind closed doors, she watched everything. Like a woman clocking a lab experiment. A behavior support study. A psychology of language trial. One night, I saw her reading a book on cognitive strategies and group behavior, highlighted dog-eared, like a surgeon prepping for a delicate procedure. "What's that for?" I asked. She smiled without looking up. Understanding human dynamics is an art form. My gut twitched, but my heart was already hostage. Looking back now, I realized she wasn't falling for me. She was learning me. My speech patterns. My preferences. My triggers. She made me believe we were a team. But she was building a profile. One night, I asked if she loved me. I'll never forget how she answered. "You make me feel safe. That's bigger than love." I smiled at the time. I didn't realize that safe meant useful. She made me feel seen. But only so she could find the best angle to cut me from. There's a moment, in every manipulative relationship, where you stop trusting yourself, long before you stop trusting them. That moment came on a Tuesday. She had been gone for 2 days. No explanation. No message. No calls. Then, out of nowhere, she showed up at my condo wearing my favorite black dress and holding Thai takeout like nothing had happened. "Sorry," she said, kissing me slow. "I just needed to clear my head. I didn't ask questions. I didn't demand answers." Because the second her lips hit mine, the mind racing stopped. She knew it. And that's when I realized I was no longer holding the leash. After that, the emotional whiplash started. Warm mornings. Cold nights. She'd cling to me in public like I was her anchor. Then go quiet during dinner, staring past me like I wasn't even in the room. She'd say things like, "You don't really know me. Sometimes I think I'm just another project for you. I hate how good you are at control." Those were her weapons. Little cuts dressed as confessions. I tried to fix it. More gifts. More reassurance. More trips. We flew to Costa Rica, then Morocco, then back to New York in 1 week. As if distraction could replace clarity. I told myself this was just passion. That we were navigating deep emotions in a complicated world. But what I didn't see then was that Amanda wasn't confused. She was crafting confusion. There's a name for what she did. It's called intermittent reinforcement, a tactic used by con artists and manipulators throughout behavioral psychology and cognitive psychology studies. Give them attention, then pull it away. Make them crave the next high. Rewire their expectations. Turn love into a variable reward system. And I, a man who taught market dynamics, persuasion methods, and work dynamics to CEOs, was now chasing her approval like a lab rat chasing a sugar cube. The sex got more intense. Rougher. Messier. More desperate. She started saying things mid-fuck like, "You don't trust me. You're addicted to control. I could break you if I wanted to." At the time, it felt sexy. Now, I realize it was a form of audio manipulation. A verbal tether wrapped in erotic moans and psychological barbs. She was teaching me to depend on her. Training me to forget who I was before she entered the picture. And the worst part, I was starting to believe her. I started doubting myself. My emotional intelligence. My instincts. Every time I asked for clarity, she twisted it. "Why are you being paranoid? You're too used to controlling everything. You can't dominate me like your boardroom." It was gaslighting at a master level. And I apologized, over and over, for things I didn't even do, because the alternative, losing her, felt worse than being wrong. One night, she said, "You make me feel like a ghost sometimes." She wasn't crying. She was performing, and I was front row. I pulled her into my arms and whispered, "I see you. You matter. I'm not going anywhere." What I didn't realize was that every time I reassured her, I gave up another inch of myself. And Amanda? She didn't want love. She wanted leverage. I look back at that period and think of it like a psychological art piece. She was the artist. I was the canvas. And each emotional breakdown was another brushstroke in her masterpiece of mental manipulation. She wasn't breaking me. She was shaping me into a man too afraid to walk away, too in love to see the trap. I used to believe I was the anomaly, the one man who couldn't be played. Not because I was invincible, but because I was aware. I taught seminars on influence techniques. I trained Fortune 500 executives on psychological principles and cognitive behavior. Hell, I once shut down a $40 million Ponzi scheme using nothing but language cues and a single deleted email. But none of that mattered. Because when your heart's involved, your tools become toys. And Amanda? She made me put down every weapon. Just long enough to stab me clean. The discovery wasn't cinematic. There was no scandalous voicemail. No lipstick on a collar. Just a forgotten iPad and a note in her drafts folder. It read, "He's almost ready. One more week. I just need to steer the convo toward the foundation proposal. After that, we're done." My name wasn't mentioned. But I knew. I knew. It was my voice she'd been manipulating. My influence she was borrowing. My love she was counting on to fund her next move. I sat with the screen in my lap. Still. Silent. My heart was sprinting, but my brain was frozen. All I could hear were her words from a week earlier. "You're the only one who truly sees me." Lies. Layered, intimate, surgical lies. She didn't just seduce me, she researched me. Like a subject in a case study on human emotion and persuasion psychology. And I let her. I invited it. That night, I waited for her to come home. I had wine poured. Candlelight flickering. Fake calm. She walked in glowing, some faux innocence on her face, lips glossed, blouse unbuttoned just enough to disarm me. "Hey, baby," she smiled. "You look intense." I didn't waste time. "Who's the message for Amanda?" Her eyes didn't flinch. That was the first punch. She glanced at the screen. Then back at me. Then, like the con artist she was, she tilted her head and whispered, "You're snooping through my devices now. Redirection. Offense is defense. Classic technique. Who's it for?" I repeated, my voice sharper. She stepped closer, barefoot on hardwood, eyes glassy. "You know what hurts more than anything? That you'd think I'm using you. And then tears. Real ones. Maybe. Or maybe she'd just mastered the body language of betrayal. Learned the psychology of crime, so well she could cry on cue. You're not the man I thought you were," she whispered. "I thought you understood complexity. I thought you saw past things like this." She flipped it. In 90 seconds, I was on defense. "I didn't mean to invade," I began. "You did invade," she cut. "And that says more about you than anything I wrote." Her ability to reframe was lethal. A lesson in narrative manipulation. We didn't argue. She didn't storm out. She didn't confess. She stayed the night. In my bed. In my arms. Like a ghost wrapping itself around the man it just haunted. I didn't sleep. I lay there, tracing the story backward. Every laugh. Every look. Every carefully curated moment. I wasn't her lover. I was her subject. She had been cataloging me like a high-level behavioral exploration project, documenting what made me weak, what made me angry, what made me open my heart and my wallet at the same time. And me? I was too flattered by the fantasy to see the specter behind her smile. I spent the next few days in silence. Didn't confront her again. Didn't snoop. Didn't call. Just watched. Because sometimes, when you truly want to understand a manipulative personality, you don't interrogate it. You observe it. And I was done being in love. Now, I was a journalist again. And Amanda Stewart? She was about to become my most introspective investigation yet. There's a peculiar silence that follows emotional detonation. Not rage. Not grief. Just silence. Like your mind has stopped broadcasting and gone fully internal, running background diagnostics on every decision you ever made. That's where I was. Sitting in my penthouse. Lights off. Phone on airplane mode. Listening to the low hum of the city 47 floors below, while the woman I thought I loved showered in the next room like nothing had ever happened. Amanda Stewart was still here. But the Amanda I thought I knew? That woman didn't exist. She never did. Hiring a private investigator was instinctual. Old reflex. I had done it dozens of times for business. To vet partners, trace shell companies, monitor market dynamics, and sniff out legal exposure. But this was different. This was personal. Psychological. I wasn't chasing money. I was chasing truth, the kind buried beneath perfume, moans, and carefully curated emotional warfare. The PI was discreet. Old school. One of those doesn't exist on LinkedIn types. I handed him three things. A photo. Her phone number. And the words. Find out who she really answers to. 3 days later, I got the call. Short. Brutal. Surgical. She's got a boyfriend. Real one. Been with him for almost 2 years. Lives in Crown Heights. She goes there on days she needs space. I didn't respond. Name's Carter. Gym rat. Drives a matte black Charger. They met at a rooftop party. He runs scams, crypto, fake NFTs, online manipulation schemes. She helps him get to people like you. I sat in my office chair, jaw locked, stomach flipped. My heart was pounding like it was trying to outrun the facts. They've done this before, he added. Different city. Different guy. Pattern's the same. Pattern. That word broke me. Because I wasn't just played. I was recycled. Another pin on a wall. Another data point in their emotional warfare operation. I confronted her the next morning. No shouting. No violence. Just surgical truth. Carter says hi. She froze, just for a split second. But it was there. A microexpression only a man trained in body language and cognitive psychology would notice. Her voice came low, rehearsed. I don't know what you think you know. I didn't answer. I just slid the photos across the table. Them. Kissing. Laughing. Hugging like people who never had to lie to each other. She didn't cry. Didn't scream. She smiled. That cold, clinical, influenced psychology smile, like I'd finally passed her last test. So now you know, she whispered. What are you going to do, Michael? I stared at her. Not the woman. Not the body. Not the sex. The specter. The engineered intelligence that had studied me down to my emotional patterns, mapped my social influence, exploited my leadership identity, and walked me blindfolded into hell. Why? I asked genuinely. Why do this to anyone? She tilted her head. Because men like you don't learn unless you're broken open. And just like that, I understood. I wasn't just her mark. I was her methodology. An introspective conversation she needed to conduct to justify her own emptiness. She kissed my cheek like she was tucking in a child and said, "You'll survive. You're built for survival." Me? I'm built for control. Then she left. No suitcase. No explanation. Just a draft in the air and silence in her place. I spent that night curled into my own thoughts. The grief wasn't loud. It was surgical. Clean cuts where my confidence used to be. Shadowed secrets where trust had once lived. She never stole money. Never crashed my business. She didn't need to. Because what she broke can't be audited. She broke my belief in intimacy. In instinct. In truth itself. The thing is, I still dream about her. Not sexually. not angrily, just as a concept, a puzzle with a missing corner, a ghost coded in psychological dynamics and human engineering. And sometimes I wonder, did she ever actually feel anything for me? Or was I always just a lesson in emotional exploration? Pain makes some men disappear. It made me document. I didn't go on a revenge spree. Didn't leak photos. Didn't torch Amanda's name across the whisper networks of New York high society. That would have been too easy, and too much like her. No. Instead, I did what I do best. I wrote. And for the first time in years, I told the unfiltered narrative. Mine. I turned the penthouse office into a studio. Stripped out the deals. Soundproofed the windows. Red lit the corner lamp. Left a single mic and a hard drive titled Celestial Insights, a true story of psychological manipulation. No names. No cities. No revenge. Just truth. Carefully structured. Deliberately paced. A first-person account of what it's like to be dismantled, piece by piece, by someone you trusted with your softest parts. I wasn't exposing Amanda. I was exposing myself. Episode 1 launched under an alias. Inside the lab. Notes from a man who got played. Within 3 days, the feed exploded. First, the true crime fans. Then the psychology junkies. Then the therapists. Then the men who never admitted they'd been manipulated until they heard my voice say. I thought love was a gift. She knew it was a weapon. It spread like wildfire. Reddit threads. Clips on TikTok. Podcasters quoting it during interviews. DMs from other men who said they hadn't cried in 10 years until Chapter 4. Women, too, some furious, others haunted. All of them listening. Not to Amanda's name, but to what she represented. The hidden mistress of modern relationships. Power. Control. Unregulated intimacy. The seductive performance of vulnerability, used to extract validation, access, and emotional oxygen. I included everything. The gaslighting. The strategic silence. The sex as compliance tool. The message she never meant for me to see. Even the moment I questioned my own intelligence, because that was the worst crime she ever committed, making me distrust my own mind. I started to hear the word victim. Interviews. Comments. Headlines. But I rejected it. Because I wasn't a victim. Not anymore. Victims don't write the script. They don't reframe the narrative. They don't get to walk others out of the same fire they burned in. I did. That's mastery, not of others, but of myself. I never saw Amanda again. But one night, deep in my DMs, came a single message. I listened. You tell a beautiful story, Michael. You always did. No name. No photo. But I knew. It wasn't guilt. It was a nod, from one storyteller to another. And maybe, just maybe, she never intended to destroy me. She just needed to know if a man like me could survive her. And I did. Because pain becomes power. When you choose to narrate the ending,